of the Mud Puppy Games Network.
I wish there was a way to know you're in the good old days before you've actually left them.
Welcome to the Save for Path podcast, where we'll talk about old school games and the modern games inspired by them.
Howdy, everybody. It's DM Mike, the guy who used to be in charge of Save for Half. With me is the new person who's lead host for Save for Half, DM Liz.
Very funny. Hello.
And the guy who is smart enough to avoid being lead cast on this podcast, DM Corbett.
I thought DM Mike was just a myth, like Bigfoot. Oh, but hi.
Yeah. Rumor has it. I don't believe it.
Like the unicorn, only the pure can see him.
We're not going to say pure what, but pure. Yeah, let's go with that.
That sounds like a Monster Manual reference. Not sure from what
book. Speaking of which, we're talking about the Holmes Basic D&D set today. That granddaddy of the basic sets. We're not going to make the mistake that I did when we covered Basic Expert, Moldvay Cook, and try to cover twice in one show. We're just covering the basic rules, not the advanced rules, which it constantly tells you to go to in the book.
Wouldn't it be the weird uncle? Because really the granddaddy would be the brown books, right?
But not a basic set. It's the oldest basic rule set that's out.
Oh, okay.
Believe me, brown book was a lot of things, but basic wasn't it.
Although I guess you could make an argument as far as covering the advanced version of this. We are eventually going to get to covering the Blue Home Journeyman set. And one could make an argument that it is an advanced version of Holmes.
True. As long as there's no companion master or immortal Holmes, I'm cool with that. you hear me, Vile Traveler? You better not have, like, Blue Home Immortals. That's all I'm saying.
Could happen.
Yeah.
You know, what do you do when you get to level 21?
You start a new character. That's what you do.
I've never made it to level 21. I usually quit before then and start a new character. I would not have any clue.
Let's find even bigger dragons to kill. Or we could do the old school thing and just break out the deities and demigods. And...
Oh, no.
Zeus, I'm totally going to whack him. Well, we're talking about Holmes Basic. Or we will as soon as we get past important announcements. Anyone have any important announcements that are important to announce?
Well, I suppose we could announce that we have finally received all of our prizes from the top secret contest that we had last year.
Woohoo! Only 7 months.
But better late than never, the prizes have been received from TSR, and they are going to be mailed out as of the weekend of this recording. So hopefully by the time people are actually listening to this, the winners will have gotten their stuff. And if you haven't, please let us know. We're going to have tracking numbers and stuff on the things, so hopefully if there's a problem, we can track down what happened to your swag.
And if there was a problem, where would they write to, Liz?
I have no idea. So there.
Uh-huh.
I'm assuming it's Save for Half. Yes, thank you.
Sorry, Save for Half podcast at gmail.com.
And if I remember right, the prize was $10,000 in delicate porcelain shipped with no packing material, right?
Yeah, I think that's it, yeah.
No. It was $10,000 worth of Swedish fish.
A lifetime supply
of Swedish fish. Fishy, fishy, I-O, we want fish. Anyway.
I'll have you know they are tasty.
Especially in 5-pound increments. All right. Well, if no one else has the announcement, then we shall go to our incredibly important announcements and commercials and fun things. Then we will come back to Top 5.
Into a world without nearly enough quality gamer podcasts, they came. The Grognard Files, a podcast about role-playing games from back in the day. You know they're experts because they speak with British accents. Find them at armchairadventureblog.com, iTunes, or wherever fine podcasts are served.
The day of liberation is here. Throughout history, only the biggest and strongest survive. Being big means you're successful, and women love big men.
Kilimanjaro.
And as a successful man, you need to feel comfortable when you're sitting down to eat.
Kilimanjaro.
Clothes for the bigger man. Don't be bound by society, bogus medicine, and the media with their unhealthy focus on being skinny. Don't be constrained by trying to squeeze into a triple X. Bored of feeling like a man in a sausage skin in your size 48 jeans? Bored of being uncomfortable?
Kilimanjaro.
Kilimanjaro, the clothes shop for enormous men. We're fighting to end hunger. Yours.
Kilimanjaro.
Top 5, Holmes Basic Dungeons & Dragons, the one my dad bought at Sears for me for Christmas.
Wow.
Yeah. In fact, it was at very Sears I went to and got my Monster Manual, which was the first AD&D book I ever owned. Yeah.
The only place you can buy a lawnmower and a gaming manual. That's awesome.
Yeah. Although, as a friend of mine pointed out, hassle-free miniatures can now be bought at Walmart.
Really?
Or at least on Walmart.com.
Huh. Well, that means they're probably in some store somewhere.
Some store somewhere. Kind of full circle going here.
I found the Victorious DM screen on the Walmart online available for purchase, and I had to tell Mike about it, and he's going, what?
Victorious at Walmart? Well, and why just the DM screen?
Well, to be fair, I didn't look for other stuff.
Okay.
But
it is the most important thing.
I'll assume that if they've got the screen, you can probably get the other stuff there, but it just seemed really bizarre.
I mean, it's a nice enough screen, I guess, although it's in the 2-panel sections, which I don't like personally, but seemed to be the thing the kids are getting now.
You kids in your DM screens?
Well, it's bad enough they already make them landscape size.
I like those.
I don't. DM screen is something you're supposed to be able to lurk behind.
Lurk.
Look up just your eyes showing like the Dawn of the Dead poster from 78. You know,
we should let people know.
Gaze balefully at your players. Can't do that with a landscape screen.
We should
screen.
Let people know that DM Mike only uses a 4-foot by 10-foot screen with eye slits to look through at his players, just to freak them out.
But it has lots of handy tables on the outside. And believe me, with 10 feet, there's plenty of room for tables. Anyway, Basic Dungeons & Dragons. With that, was that a Sutherland or a Trampier cover? I forget. The dragon and the little wizard and the fighter.
I thought
fighter.
It was Sutherland, actually. Wasn't it?
Was it Sutherland? Okay. That iconic Sutherland cover art. Just awesome. Awesome game. But for those of you who are not aware of Dungeons & Dragons, you create a character by having 6 attributes. Strength, intelligence, wisdom, constitution, dexterity, charisma, in that order.
That's right.
And then you choose a class, and in this game, race is a class, so fighter, magic user, cleric, thief, elf, dwarf, halfling.
Actually, wasn't it fighting man?
Is it fighting man? Yes,
just saying it. Fighting man,
not fighting man,
not woman. No, no.
Well, strictly speaking, in the first couple of editions, it was Hobbit.
Ooh,
but
yeah.
That had to go away because, as you know, D&D was not influenced any way whatsoever by Tolkien. That was TSR's legal stand, and they stuck by it. So you make a character, you run around in dungeons, kill things, and take their stuff. And that was the basic. This set covered you from levels 1 to 3, with lots of comments that if you wanted higher levels, you should go to advanced Dungeons & Dragons. Now, a lot of people think that's weird today, but I have to, in TSR's defense, there were a lot of games in the 70s that had basic and advanced rules. So it really wasn't as weird as it originally looked.
Advanced and, squad leader.
She said advanced squad leader. Quick, roll for a sniper. Anyway.
Advanced Call of Cthulhu.
Oh, sorry. Roll for a scout. Well, Traveler didn't do that. They went to Mega Traveler rather than Advance. So it was supersized Traveler. So anyway.
Actually, it was. Wasn't Mega Traveler technically bigger than the regular small books that Traveler came
in? Well, they were 8.5 by 11. Yeah, they got away from the digest size.
So
Mega
it
Traveler.
Was supersized Traveler.
It was.
But we're not talking about Traveler.
Probably not as good for you to eat. But I never ate any, so I don't know.
Oh, boy.
Much like I was even a sort of grog back in the 80s, because when Mega Traveler came out, my thought was, Traveler works just fine. What do I need advanced Traveler for?
My starships run on hay, and I like it.
On rare and incredibly expensive hydrogen. Which is extremely rare.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So how about this Holmes thing?
Basic. Corbett, so looking at Holmes Basic, what's your first impressions?
It was kind of fun to read and rethink the way that things molded into the Moldvay design. But my first basic impression? Ha ha ha. Pun.
Ha. Ba-dum-ching.
But no, my first impression that really struck me was actually, I guess, a complaint, and it was the same complaint I had about a certain Victorian-based superhero game, which I won't name. But but there's just not a lot of art. It was totally fine. The art is in it. It's really neat. But it didn't feel like there was as much. So
man, you would have hated Old Traveler.
No, I read Old Traveler. You remember we do this show together, right?
Yeah. I'm surprised you didn't bash that in Traveler then.
Well,
or did you? And I've just forgotten.
No, I think it was a complaint I had, actually. I may have kept it to myself because it was a fun read. And that's the same with Holmes. It's still a fun read. I think mostly the stuff I was picking at was more nitpicky stuff and just interesting things to me. It still is a solid game.
Well, especially with role-playing games now, modern gamers, it probably would really strike them hard, the lack of art, because art has become so integral to role-playing games now. There are some games, you know, you literally have one piece of art per page.
I don't want to overdo it, but I want to say the Player's Handbook from Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. That first big piece, the Paladin in Hell, it's like a whole page piece. It's a really cool piece.
Yeah.
Set you in the mood for, wow, I'm going to fight a bunch of big monsters. And there was art in Holmes. Don't let me play it off as like, it's the Bible. But
and not the Comics Illustrated.
It was just very sporadic, and it didn't have a lot of big pieces yet. But I think a lot of it, too, was they're making new ground. So
yeah,
what was there was totally new for them. I'm sure in comparison to the Brown books, it was probably like filled with art. So there you go.
Yeah. Of course, the Brown books had the booger art in a lot of it. So, but yeah, you're right about this new ground. Nobody had ever put a role-playing game into a mass-market store before, or even a war. Well, sort of war games had sort of done it back in the days of Avalon Hill, but certainly not in the 70s.
But yeah, a lot of the verbiage would caught me that way. That it was like, well, this is how you would do it. Like, how would you not do it? I think they talked about dice, like for the first time ever.
Mm-hmm. Well. Holmes's manuscript for Basic, thing is, when J. Eric Holmes submitted the manuscript, it was a rewrite of the original D&D. Gygax was the one that just took it and kind of chopped it down to make a basic D&D out of it. So he was trying to go from the mindset of, this needs to be more user-friendly right out the gate. And yeah, Brown Book has its charms, but it ain't user-friendly. Mm. Okay, Liz, what was your first impressions? I know that's kind of hard to say because, like me, it was your first RPG, so...
Yeah, any reread of Holmes Basic is very heavily tinged with nostalgia for me. I will always love it the best, even though I will also admit that other later versions of Basic explained things more clearly to a new player. But Holmes is still my baby, and I like it better. Every time I reread the Holmes Basic booklet, I am struck by how J. Eric Holmes just says very bluntly the things you can do. It's not flowery text, and he's very clear and concise without talking down to the reader, which was one of the things that I personally disliked about, I guess it was the Marsh Cook.
Mulvey.
Yeah, Marsh Cook Mulvey version of the rules. Mm. I felt like the text was talking down to me. And part of that, I think, was I had already had the Holmes book, and then I had the AD&D books, and I slogged my way through the very adult writing in those. And then to get Mulvey and read their version of the basic rules, I felt like I was being talked down to. So I think Holmes was clear without writing as though he thinks the reader's a little slow. So... that's one of the things that I still appreciate about the rules. You get the gist of the game in only a little over 40 pages, and the last few pages of that is your sample dungeon. I mean, realistically, you've got the whole game and some example monsters and magic items in, you know, like 36 pages, more or less.
Yeah, and the original basic set came in a box with the blue rule book, which had a replica of the cover art, of the box cover art on the front, but in blue and white, a module, either B1, In Search of the Unknown, or B2, Keep on the Borderlands, depending on which edition you bought, and either the wonderful, wonderful TSR low-impact dice or chits. But I'll talk about chits later.
Actually, I do want to say, I sent this to Liz as an email years ago, but when my daughter was 12, she wanted to try out D&D, and like you and probably a lot of our listeners, you have a wall of books from years and years and years of collecting.
I don't know what you're talking about.
So I was just like, oh, just make a character and try it out, and here's a, you know, there's the advanced, here's this, here's the second edition, the third edition, you know, it's walking her through like decades of history, and like, but probably you should just grab this box, and it was my Mulvey Cook box, and it's got a Holmes book in it, and I didn't realize I'd put my Holmes book in there, but it was, and she pulled that out. She was using a Mulvey Cook character sheet, but she had made a character using the Holmes rule book. And she's like, oh, this is really easy. I get this.
I remember that email.
It was just kind of funny that she picked up on it so easy and then tried to pick up the books and just like looked at it like schoolwork, which I think was my reaction back when the books came out.
Well, yeah, and like we discussed, I at least came to role-playing from a different direction than you did. I came kind of from wargaming, and you came kind of from let's pretend, so...
Sorry, I'm happy-go-lucky, you warmonger.
I'll lay down a suppressive fire with my incinerators and fall back by squads to the APC, over.
I'll turn it into sprinkly rain. Anyway.
Anyway. All right, well, let's get to our numbers then, shall we? And I'll start with Corbett, since he's turning my incinerators into sprinkly rain.
Well, I'll do what any good gamer / wargamer would do and turn it into math.
Woohoo! Ta-da!
Because as you probably have been wondering, and this was something that for some reason just struck me, I bet you've been wondering what the encumbrance rules are all about.
That's the first thing I look for in any role game, is the encumbrance rule.
And then grappling.
No. Yep. I actually learned something I never thought or cared about, and neither will you. But now you can know about it and not care too.
Lay it on us, then. What are we not going to care about?
In the encumbrance rules, and it's a short little paragraph that you would pretty much glaze past, I guarantee you. But he does clarify that 300 gold pieces equals 30 pounds. I broke that down by the numbers and found out that one gold piece would be about a gram to a gram and a half, which is about equal to a dime. And I never thought about this, but that would be what a gold piece is. It would be about the size of a dime. I always presume they're like giant gold doubloons or something.
Yeah, because 1/10 of a pound.
Yeah, they're super tiny. And I looked it up, and each gold piece, being the size of a dime, weighing roughly a gram, is $50 in American currency right now. So there you go.
So now you know what you want to convert your gold pieces into dollars, what it'll be.
I don't know.
Now I know. And knowing is half the battle.
Save for
And for those of you looking to buy gold, gold is really affordable right now. You should look into our gold land here at gold.gold.org.
Well, and also I kind of looked up to see, because I kept going back to ogres as my reference.
And ogres.
Well, an average ogre walks around with 500 or what's it, 100 to 600 gold pieces casually, which is like 60 pounds in gold if you think about that. But that's beside the point. So each ogre casually is walking around with $500 to $30,000.
And they're good tippers.
Apparently.
You'd think their caves would be better appointed with luxury items, but
you'd
no.
You'd think, and they'd dress better.
You'd think they'd have, gold-plated
spinning
rims.
So your number five is...
Gold!
Gold-to-dollar conversion rates. Gotcha.
And the size of a gold coin. I never really thought or cared about. Like, who cares? It's a gold coin.
I often thought if I ever became stinking rich, what I would do is get like 100 actual gold coins minted to keep in a bag so that when we're playing, you can go, oh, you want to know how much 100 gold pieces weigh? Boom, right there, baby. Now you tell me how you're going to carry 3,000 gold pieces. So, Liz, your number five?
My number five. Okay. Later on in the booklet, they talk about the roles of the various players. And among those is someone being appointed as the caller.
Ah, yes.
I have got to say the concept of the caller is one that I never actually used when I was running games for my friends way back when. Usually I think it was because we were such a small group. It seemed a bit overkill to have someone be the caller. It's like, well, there's me running the game and there's two people playing. I'm just going to let people talk. You know? But I can see the usefulness of it if you have a large group of players. You've got eight to ten people sitting around a table. You're going to want to have someone designated as the person who says what's going on. You know, otherwise you just got a big wall of noise as everyone is arguing with each other.
Exactly.
In normal groups, though, at least any of the ones that I was a part of, either as a DM or a player, we never had a caller. Never.
Mm.
So, I mean, I remember reading about it, and it just never came into play for me.
The only time I ever recall a caller being used was in a D&D tournament at a convention. But generally, they didn't. And I talked to some of the old TSR guys about this, and they said that back when D&D first came out, it wasn't unusual to have 15 to 20 people at a table. And if that's the case, then yeah, I can definitely see the need for a caller.
I don't know if either of you read this, but this caught my attention. It's like the example of play. If I was watching it happen, I think I would lose my mind. Because it's basically the DM presents a situation. The caller says what they're going to do. The DM responds to the caller. The caller responds back to the DM. The DM responds to the caller. The caller responds back to the DM.
Yeah.
Somebody randomly says, hey, that's cool.
And every once in a great while, a player other than the caller says something briefly.
Yeah.
Yeah. In real play, that's never how it happened.
No. I mean, that would basically be like a Captain Kirk kind of play where like, okay, what are you going to do? I'm going to fire the phasers by telling that guy to fire the phasers.
The fighter is going to attack the three ogres. And the player who's got the fighter is going, what? I'm what?
Then you can take Cage back to hell. What? Trust me, Cage, it's the only way. What are you talking about? See, he was the caller. Jack Black was the caller.
That's the good example.
Yeah. Okay, so you're the caller. Yep. Mine, race as class. I thought that was a really interesting way of dealing with demi-humans at the time. And I thought for a game that's supposed to introduce people to role-playing, I thought it was a neat, quick way of getting people up and in the game rather than nitpicking about the race, then the class, then you know what I mean. I also like the idea of it being iconic. If you run into an elf, dwarf, or a halfling, they're going to more or less be like this. And to me, that kind of made them more different than humans, because humans can be all over the place. Whereas an elf, 99% of the time, he's going to be like this. Dwarf, she's going to be like that. So I really like the idea of the races class. I think that should have been carried on further, but not gnomes.
Did I read it wrong? I remember in the Fighting Man it said that
yes, dwarf. Yes, I was going to go into that too.
Okay,
but yeah.
Then you do it, Liz.
Oh, Corbin and I both picked up on this. Under Fighting Men, it says all halflings and dwarves are members of the fighter class unless they opt to be thieves.
Yeah.
But then you read under thieves, there are special rules for halflings, dwarves, and elves who wish to be thieves. These are given in advanced Dungeons and Dragons.
Uh-huh.
Are you saying there are a few inconsistencies in Holmes?
Just a few.
Well, I just think that, well, it does put forward the idea of, wait a minute, you could play a class and a race at the same time? That sounds dodgy.
Well, again, Holmes originally wrote this as a rewrite of OD&D, where you can certainly do that. Although, the way they used to do elf fighter magic users in original was just bizarre. You had to choose what class you were going to be that day, and you had to be that. And if you decided to be a wizard, you couldn't wear armor. And if you were a fighter, you couldn't use any spells. It's just weird. But I like Grace's class, so bah. Number four, Corbett.
I just want to applaud that now that Mike's back, we have 100% more bah in the podcast.
Bah! That's right. Actually, I'm trying to really bah to make up for the last episode.
Correction.
100% more bah, 75% more humbug.
Yep. And at least 50% more Liz sighing. Exactly.
Okay. I'm going to complain about weapons.
Weapons?
Yes.
What about weapon?
I think his numbers are way wrong.
In what regard?
In specifically to the ranged weaponry. I was looking at all the ranged weaponry. I was looking at the ranged weaponry, and it's Wheelie Wong.
Very, very quiet. I'm hunting ogres because they have big cash.
They do. Those guys got a 401k or something, is all I'm saying.
Hey, kill an ogre, all you do is find a portfolio with some bank statements.
Wow,
hey, you kill an ogre, you are set for life. You don't even have to go to dungeoneering anymore.
Well, you think about what the average peasant earns. Yeah, you kind
of
would.
Well, you've heard of the wolves of Wall Street. These are the ogres.
Ogres of Wall Street.
Ugh, think wolf bull market good for... I can't even do it. I can't even do it.
The bull market is actually minotaurs. And...
No, ogres say put money in Minotaur. Minotaur up this year.
Yeah, the Holmes Basic really focuses a lot on the economy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, sure it does.
So anyway. The longbow. The longbow has a range of 210 feet, which is like 70 yards.
In a dungeon.
Is it in a dungeon? Is it all in a dungeon?
Yeah, the default is in a dungeon, and the range is supposed to be converted to yards for outdoors.
Oh, okay. Wow, you got me for not reading on that one.
Actually, it may not even be in Holmes. It may be in AD&D. I don't remember exactly. I know that was the case, but I don't know if it was spelled out specifically in Holmes.
Well, just
I think
like,
it was. But,
well, the hand axe throw was like 10 feet. And I'm pretty sure I could throw an axe further than 10 feet. Now, granted, not accurately, because I'm not an axe thrower, but...
Yeah, I was about to say, but could you hit someone accurately?
Well, I could hit someone, maybe not with a bladed edge, but...
Might be my friend, but I'm going to hit somebody.
Well, okay,
wow.
Okay.
Not with the blade, maybe on the side.
Well, the javelin is a range of, 20 to 40 medium, and they can throw them, like... 87 yards or something in the Olympics, which granted is outdoors, but still, It's like those numbers seem way out of whack.
First level, and I'm sure none of them are fighting men wearing armor, carrying shields and backpacks while they're throwing that javelin. But
fine, defend it all you want. I just think the numbers are weird.
I'm only half defending it because you're right. And as far as dungeon goes, if they're in a really big cavern, then just doing it in a dungeon kind of goes out the window. So
true. Well,
no, I think you're right.
I just don't know if it was Maybe I have to go back through and re-read it. Let's do a second show.
I think some of the numbers, again, he took the numbers from OD&D, so probably we have to blame Gary Gygax.
Well, I know they spell out in the little section about time and movement in the dungeons,
mm-hmm.
about feet, turns, scale time, not actual time, etc., etc. I don't recall if they make that distinction when they were doing the weapon ranges in Holmes, though.
Yeah.
Like I said, a lot of my things are little picky things. They're just kind of... I'll talk more about gold. You go ahead.
Gold.
Okay. Liz?
My number 4. Okie dokie. I'm going to talk about monsters.
Yay.
I tend to like their monster manual section. You have very brief descriptions of what the monsters are. It's enough to get you going. You've got your stats. Some of them, like the Minotaur, have very snarky humor connected with them. So those are always fun to just kind of read. You know, everything is serious. And then suddenly here's this brief little blurb where they're just kind of poking fun at gamers in general.
Yeah, what did something along the lines of...
A bullheaded man, which we have all run across when arguing rules at the table or something like that, you know.
War gamers are quite familiar with.
Yes. But one of the things that I noticed going through the monsters, you've got giant versions of, you've got the giant ant, the giant centipede, the giant rat, the giant tick. But when you get to the spider, suddenly you've got a large spider, a huge spider, and a giant spider. Where are the large and huge versions of all of these other critters that apparently only come in giant size, but spiders are just all over the place, and they can either be the size of your head or the size of a small Shetland pony. I don't know.
Well, but... Liz, those spiders are right over by the nuclear waste dump. If you'll go look.
I was bitten by a radioactive centipede. A radioactive earwig.
Yeah.
All the powers of an earwig.
I'm not sure what those would be, but okay.
But yeah, so I am earwiggy.
Captain Earwig.
Exactly. Sorry, everyone. A little leftover from Super Babes. I guess probably the point is spiders are a lot more popular.
I guess, but I mean, you could have all different sizes of everything. Why did spiders get special treatment?
I was kind of confused that 10% of all the monsters were edible.
Yeah.
Well, technically, puddings, jellies.
I'm not sure I'd have any of those edible.
Well, just there was 57 monsters in total. I counted them because I have an OCD thing going on, apparently. but 6 of them are some type of gelatinous, goopy something or other. So.
Yes, jellies. Jellies, puddings.
Like, that's really weird to me.
I think they just had like a blob of some like brown plastic or something. And you know, so it's like, you're in a dungeon and here's a brown pudding. Build some chocolate pudding.
Yeah, that I can see.
Ah, the brown pudding is coming to get you.
Gee, a gamer spilling food on the game mat? Yeah.
Yeah, I know, right?
It's like, we're going to work with this.
yeah. Mm-hmm. This is what you actually run into. So that's your number 4?
My number 4.
That was her number 4.
That's why I was asking. Yes. So that's your number 4.
That was my number 4. Monsters. Okay. And griping about the various sizes of spiders.
Okay. My 4 is kind of a... And it's going to get me in trouble with Liz.
Uh-oh.
You're wrong.
I am so right.
Oh, no. I'm going to be in the middle of this? I hate a mommy and daddy fight.
Grab the black pudding. Holmes Basic is the only D&D to do this, and it has a 5 alignment system.
Oh.
It's the best alignment system.
OD&D and subsequent Basic Classic editions have 3 alignments, Law, Neutral, and Chaos.
Which are clearly too few.
Bah. Advanced D&D has 9 alliance.
Which are 4 too many.
But Holmes Basic has 5. Lawful good, chaotic good, neutral, lawful evil, chaotic evil.
Which is just right.
I don't like it.
We are like wrong. You're totally
like
wrong.
Don't like it.
Law versus chaos in action.
And on a side note, I just note that the original Monster Manual only has 5 alignments in it, too.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I thought that was weird.
And that's how you know it's right.
Bah. Don't like it. I've never liked that. I've liked alignments to just be a general guide. I've never been a straitjackety kind of DM when it comes to alignments. Mm. Unless it's like a paladin and you kind of have to.
You know, I hate neutral. Those neutral guys with all their neutralness.
I hate the interpretation of
balanced.
Neutral.
They're pH balanced. I don't know what your problem is.
Druid, strong enough for a man. But seriously, I don't like the definition of neutrality as the balance.
Yeah.
I really like that. That's just kind of lame. Oh no, you killed those orcs, so now you're slightly stronger than evil, so attack you.
Well, see, I put it to the Star Wars test, because the Star Wars test kind of aligns things right. And there's good guys and there's bad guys in Star Wars. Like, oh, well, there's the neutral guys. Like, technically, Jabba's kind of a bad guy. He kills people.
Han Solo started as a neutral, I'd say.
That's true, but he shifted to the right way.
And he lost a level.
That's okay. He has a Wookiee. It's fine, but it's just that I think that neutral is kind of a cop-out for players to like, well, I'm just neutral.
Kind of like in AD&D, chaotic neutral becomes the cop-out.
I'm chaotic
it's
neutral.
It's either I want to do whatever I want, whenever I want, with no limitations, or I want to act insane.
Why can't I be a chaotic neutral paladin? There's chaotic neutral gods.
Yeah. Because the gods say, I'm neutral, chaotic neutral, but my followers have to do what I say anyway, so that's law. I'm a god, I get to do that, haha. That's my grouse, and Liz is wrong.
Liz is totally right. 5 alignment system rules.
Corbett,
I remain neutral. Oh, sorry. I thought you were putting
me
between
you. You're just
playing
with your black pudding.
Yes, I was. I was eating my Jell-O cube. experience. Experience seemed kind of lightweight to me. Well, lightweight unless you are a mage, and then it just sucks. a magic user.
Magic user.
I was looking at the experience level to get from first to second level. And it takes 16 ogres to get you to the first level as a fighting man. It takes 9.5 ogres to get you to the next level as a thief.
Is that counting the gold the ogres are carrying?
Well, that's a lot of gold. So
yeah.
You have to think
well,
about
I mean, in the early D&Ds, that's really where you expected to get most of your XP from was treasure, not monsters.
Well, that's why they walked around with bank vaults.
Exactly.
Yeah, kill one ogre and you can level up.
Yep.
Well, I'm retiring. We only killed one monster. Done.
One was all I needed.
All I needed. See ya.
It takes 12 ogres to level a cleric, and it takes 20 ogres to level a mage. Sorry, magic user. And it just seems...
But if each ogre was carrying 500 gold, mage would be like third or fourth level.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
See?
So you definitely want to be killing ogres, is my point.
Ogres. That's the takeaway here. Ogres.
We use the ogre standard at the at the Holmes Basic D&D game.
Here we have an ogre-based economy. We trade in your ogre for a brand new one. Because everybody needs an ogre to kill and level up. But you can only go up to third level, so don't kill too many.
At 4 hit dice, they are not going to be killed easily, let me tell you.
No, they're not. For one thing, they'll throw their gold at you.
That's true.
Bag of gold.
And if you're a first level mage and you get hit with a solid bag of gold, that could kill you.
It really could.
Yeah, I mean, that's like
one hit and you're done.
Yeah, it's like those little bags of lead pellets they use to mug people, you know? That would be like one the size of a grocery bag. Whack you. Whack you good. So,
okay, that was my
like
number.
It or don't, I assume you don't like it.
It seems like it's really, really imbalanced against the mage. I just think that's like,
Yeah.
The two people that are probably, well, technically the fighting man also has it just about as bad as the mage. 16 ogres, that's a lot of ogres to kill. Have you killed 16 ogres lately? I doubt it. your bank says.
If you factor in the gold, that gets to maybe 3 ogres.
Really? That's a lot.
Right? Well, if each one has 500 gold on him, that's 1,500 XP right there.
That's true. It's also almost $100,000, so...
Yeah.
And if they stand in a pyramid form, it's a $100,000 pyramid!
Welcome to Pyramid of Ogres!
Things that go grunt. Things that yell at you. Things that have
clubs. Pyramid
clubs.
Of Ogres!
So, with that mental image... Liz, what's your 3?
Ogres.
Welcome to the Ogre Podcast.
All ogres, all the time.
Ogre, yep. Ogre.
Yeats.
Okay, it's not ogres, unfortunately.
Okay.
I should have talked about ogres, I think, but anyway. Okay, my number 3, talking about scroll costs and magic users.
Yeah.
Scrolls are pretty darn cheap, all things considered. 100 gold pieces per level of spell. Now, some people, their first thought might be, well, scrolls are that cheap. That's kind of unbalanced, isn't it? But the game specifically does state, magic users cannot bring their spellbooks into the dungeon with them.
Period.
Period. You can't. So if you're down in a dungeon, you fire off your spell, and then you have to sleep overnight, there's no studying your spell book while you're locked in a room to get your spell back the next day. You have to go back to town, back home, to be able to get to your spell book and study your spell again.
Because, yeah, back in early D&D, they were assuming that a spell book was like, you know, a coffee table book. But as thick as a dictionary.
You're looking at the Oxford English Dictionary.
Yeah, this monster book. And yeah, you're not taking that into a dungeon.
But what about if you're an ogre magi? Would that be... if you left your gold behind, I think you could.
I think, yeah, fine, maybe.
You might could.
Well, ogre magi can fly, so, you know, they don't worry about their spell books getting wet.
So when you take into account that your magic users cannot bring their spellbooks with them, you kind of have to have affordable scrolls so you can stock up on a handful of scrolls to be able to go down and stay in your dungeon for a couple of days, however long it takes to get the job done, and not be constantly going back to town every single day.
And if you're in a true emergency, you can just read the scroll and boom.
Wait a minute. Was there a limit on the number of scrolls you can carry?
I don't recall that.
So technically you could carry the same equivalent amount of your spellbook without it being your spellbook, but they're all scrolls?
Yeah, except when you read them.
If you had the money, you could have 10 or 12 scrolls with you if you had $1,000 to have 10 or 12 scrolls made.
Well,
most starting mages don't.
One ogre but... and we got that.
One ogre, yeah.
Maybe a half ogre.
But the whole party's gonna want to split that ogre treasure.
Plus, I believe if you use the scroll to rememorize the spell, it still disappears and destroys the scroll. You know, it's not perfect.
Either way, you got to use the scroll's going to be used up.
Yeah.
So.
And that one piece of paper weighed off you gives you more room for carrying that ogre treasure. Exactly. So yeah, actually, I point that out about the scrolls when people say, well, magic users just have the one spell and then they're useless. Like, well, not really, because if you look at the character generation, magic users end up with quite a chunk of change. And because they're wizards, magic users, they don't have much to spend it on.
Yeah, in Holmes Basic, unlike in the AD&D set, no matter what type of character you're playing, you roll the same dice to get starting gold, as opposed to in AD&D, if you're a magic user, you only get these dice to roll,
like
and you wind up...
5d4 or something.
Yeah, so you could conceivably roll really well, and since you can't purchase armor, that's a huge cost off of your plate already. You could pick up a scroll or two, conceivably, just as a starting character before you've gone into a dungeon.
Yep, and now you got 3 spells. You're a bit more versatile now. As long as it's not like ventriloquism or something like that. Magic mouth. I'm ready to go into a dungeon full of ogres. I've got magic mouth.
Hey, look
over
there.
I have Bush and friends.
Yeah. All right. My three.
Oh, yeah, you.
Yeah, I'm here. Hello.
Mike's back, everybody.
Woohoo!
We want Liz back.
Liz runs a show better.
Yeah, whatever.
Hey, she has 5 pounds of Swedish fish to back her up.
That's right. A school of them, too.
Old school.
Old school. Anyway. Alignment languages.
Oh.
Hate him. Dumb.
Okan say, Ixay, Uxay, Uxay.
Anyone thought that that was a good idea? All good people, neutral people, and evil people have a secret language that they just know, and they can talk to each other. If you can't talk their secret language, they know you're not of their alignment, so they can murderize you.
Well, it's not much of a secret then, is it?
Yeah. If you change alignment, you magically forget the old alignment language and magically know the new one.
Well, though it does seem like all of the evil alignment languages require hand gestures of kind of curling and smoothing out hands.
I do bite my thumb, sir.
Yes, yes.
Do you bite your thumb at me, sir?
So, which alignment language uses jazz hands?
I think that's totally chaotic neutral.
Okay.
Except there is no chaotic neutral in homes.
That's how chaotic it is.
That's how chaotic. That's totally.
So, that's my three. Two.
Two.
The number two. What is it, Corbett?
Well, we're getting there, aren't we?
Yeah. Blazing through. Well, it is only a 48-page book.
That's true. It was a pretty quick read and fun.
Yeah.
You know what? Unicorns suck.
I'll take your word for that.
Because I was...
Unicorns suck.
I was totally scrolling through a lot of them, and like they literally made the unicorn the least interesting unicorn I think I've ever read. Literally,
okay.
It's a slightly fast horse with the ability to teleport using a dimensional door spell, which, by the way, not in the book.
That's what makes them cool.
But they can
details. See advanced
yeah,
of dragons.
But the teleport's only like 300 feet. Which, by the way, if the range rules on arrows were corrected, that would not be far enough. I don't know. I was just expecting
maybe
like
he's
the last
teleporting
unicorn.
Teleporting behind a stalagmite or something. I don't know.
Well, they're lawful good, so. They're,
so you shouldn't be shooting them anyway.
You shouldn't be shooting them anyway, unless you're one
bad,
of the other...
Bad person.
Seven, oh, no, five alignment? No, four alignments.
Quick, Liz, talk to him in good alignment language, or lawful, and see if he can answer you. Because if he can't, then we know he's evil.
La 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 la.
La 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 la. Let's face it, if there's a lawful, that would be it.
That's probably true. But I will state that they do have the same hit dice as ogres, so they would count for the same number. So if you had to level up, you would take 16 unicorns to get to your next level.
Except
so.
They don't carry 500 gold
they
on their
They don't
butts.
Carry 500 gold. They carry zero gold. They are quite literally a horse with a horn that can teleport once.
Yep.
So again...
They're highly resistant to magic, and they will kick your ass.
All I can tell you is unicorns suck, but they make good coats.
And if you try to mess with them... Eventually, Deadpool's after you.
I guess so.
So, unicorns suck. What's your number two, Liz?
I'm not sure how to follow that up.
Yeah.
Ogres.
I'm not talking about ogres. Okay, number two. At one point, I think this is when they're going over wandering monster encounters and things like that. Holmes pretty much says that the DM should tweak the wandering monster encounters to suit the levels of the players. Mm-hmm. He says it.
So there.
I mean, he even says, if justification is needed, simply consider that a small party is relatively quiet, thus attracting less attention than a large group.
Mm.
And then he says, you roll the dice for whatever number of critters for appropriate for the monster, like kobolds, you know, 3 to 12, whatever. And he says, modify the number as required to suit the situation.
And this was mid to late 70s.
Yeah, Holmes is pretty much saying, as the DM, you are well within your rights. You don't have to be the slave of the dice.
That may be one of the first examples of that in an RPG where they And I know it's controversial because a lot of old schoolers think, nope, let the dice fall where they may. Too bad, so sad. But this is an example of shift it to make it fair and to make sure people have a good time.
So that is my number two. I had not remembered that being in the book, reading over it before. And I've had this book since I was like 11 years old. So, yeah.
Which was a good 20 years ago, right, Liz?
At least.
20 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we'll go with that.
Okay, well, my number two, and now I'm going to annoy probably Thorkammer here.
Because he's going to go number two on air. Go for it.
ew. No. 1d6 for all weapons. What?
Oh, let me get this straight. You're going off on the damage, but not the range? Dude. I'm going to speak chaotic to you, pal. Okay. D6 damage. Go ahead.
He's trying to make it easy for brand new people.
When I got this version, mine had B2 Keep on the Borderlands in it. And in that module, it gives the variable weapon damage. That and the guys I was playing with who were already old Brown Book D&D players, they already used variable weapon damage. So I never got into this. But it just drove me nuts. Everybody D6. And because of the way Holmes handled weapon speed, there was no chart like in AD&D or anything. All it did is say, you know, people with daggers can strike twice in a round. Whereas large weapons strike last in a round. In which case, who would want to have a large weapon and who wouldn't want to have two daggers?
I agree with that.
Yeah, you end up with everyone running around with two daggers in their hands, going, ha ha, doing up to 12 points of damage.
So it does seem like a wargamer thing to say.
It is a wargamer thing.
Well, on the other hand, if you are a magic user with no armor on, do you really want to get up close and personal with a lot of these things?
Well, no. You know, I'm talking fighters running around in full plate and two daggers. You laugh, but it did happen.
Well, I do think, one, he was trying to make it as easy as possible for someone coming at this with absolutely no prior gaming experience at all.
And it was original D&D before the Greyhawk supplement.
And two, I'm not sure if this was in his mindset or not. This might be something that Chris Holmes may or may not remember if when we get a chance to talk with him about it.
Sooner than you think.
But maybe also the striking twice with a dagger was a way of trying to give a little something back to a magic user who is otherwise...
Or a thief.
Yeah, kind of useless in a physical fight. It's like, well, he doesn't have very many hit points. He doesn't have armor. But if he is forced to fight hand to hand, he'll be able to strike twice because a dagger is all he's allowed to use anyway.
Anyway, 1d6 damage for all weapons. Yes, it's simple, but it's dull. And I'm not going to argue realism because I know you'll both make fun of me. So I'll just say I don't like it. Don't like it. So number one, Corbett.
All right, number one. I'm going to get racist.
Yeah. And it better have nothing to do with ogres.
Okay, so the ogre. And I'm not joking.
Oh, man.
The ogre description. They're fearsome, large, humanoid monsters, 7 to 10 feet high. That sums up the basic idea of any ogre I've ever had in my head. But the next part of the sentence in the description are of various disgusting colors. So
disgusting colors.
I looked it up. The top 10 ugliest ogre colors. We'll say ogre colors. Barf green, pink, yellow, orange, which I like orange, but whatever. Dark brown, not fair. I think that's definitely racist for ogre. Beige, dude.
I'm kind of beige.
Kind of, yet it's ugly. Top 10.
Hey!
I read it on the internet, so you can't say it's wrong.
So it must be true.
See, 7 was puce. I think it's just because of the name, really.
You're just mentioning this so you can put this in the show links, aren't you?
No. I'm sure somebody else will find a top 10 list of dumb colors, but I just think it's interesting that he specifically said disgusting colors, not just various colors.
Not just colors. Who knew?
No.
Disgusting colors.
They are disgusting colors. So if you need a pink ogre, it's probably there.
A poger. Hey, remember that that ogre that I got somewhere that got painted? Somebody painted it a light pink. He's got like a shield and a mace, and he just looks like a walking Pepto-Bismol ad.
I guess that would be your disgusting ogre.
That would be an accurate
color.
Yeah, that'd be an accurate ogre, I guess.
That would be pretty cool for Pepto-Bismol. Pepto-Bismol crushes your pain like an ogre.
Like an ogre. Colors.
Yep.
That's yours. Okay. Liz, please don't be about ogres.
Aw. My number one, he only speaks about it very briefly, but I have always appreciated where Holmes talks about so-called hopeless characters and encouraging players to stick with them and to see where they go. A lot of people don't, and I think they really miss out. I know I've mentioned this before in previous episodes on previous podcasts, Save or Die. But there was one North Texas con where I was in one of Bad Mike's basic games, and we were going through B1. One of the players at the table, she had her character, and she had an NPC zero level hireling. And during the course of the game, her character died, and so she wound up playing the zero level hireling, the nothing NPC, over the rest of the game session at the con. And that zero level hireling kicked butt. Once she started playing the hireling, she started rolling 19s, 20s. She was doing max damage. That hireling really got the opportunity to shine and was making the rest of us around the table look kind of like a bunch of losers.
It's like those dice are random.
I know, right? But by the end of the game, we were all talking about how the hireling probably needed to be the new leader of the party, and we would just do what he said. So, yeah, and if you roll up a character and not all of your numbers are what you would initially like them to be, see what happens. Sometimes you can wind up with a character that, even though they've got a 7 intelligence or something like that, they wind up being some serious players in your game world.
You never know how the dice are going to fall. That was brilliant, Liz.
I know. I really outdid myself there. That was my number one. Hopeless characters and why Holmes is right and you should give them a chance.
Okay. Well, mine, I was torn, so I think I'll go with... This is a basic game. It's made for levels first through third. It's to get people introduced into playing at low levels. So can someone tell me why they have dragons?
Because the game is called Dungeons and Dragons, Mike. Yeah. You have to have dragons.
Then why are there vampires?
That's another one.
It's not Dungeons and Vampires, though that would be kind of a cool game.
Vampires are a very iconic sort of monster to run into. So are
true.
Zombies, so are skeletons.
That's true.
But a vampire is going to totally take apart even a third level party.
If it's as sucky as the unicorn, maybe not. Let me take a look at him.
Sucky.
Nope. 7 to 9 hit dice. He's still pretty tough.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
And he's got all the traditional powers.
D10
of the vampire,
damage?
So.
Ooh, but
yeah,
he carries a lot of gold, so that's some XP.
So if you could just waste them.
That's a lot of dimes, see, people.
Well,
Corbett is exhibiting the proper mindset of the old school D&D player of the 70s.
The murder hobo.
The murder hobo who murders people and takes their stuff.
Oh, and he's got really? Regeneration. Ah, oh, jeez. Holy crap.
Yeah.
There's like 3 more paragraphs on this. Summon rats. What the heck?
Yeah.
Hey, one of the things they talk about in the book is how you can hire and or charm a monster to serve you as a character.
Mm.
You could charm an ogre and then get it to go after that vampire. Mm. And while they're battling it out, you can
take the ogre's
the
bag of gold and run off.
But I still don't get it. Did you guys see The Last Unicorn?
Yes.
How is it vampires have all their awesome stuff and unicorns blow? I just don't get it. So anyway, ogres. Sorry.
Because nobody made a role-playing game called Unicorn the Masquerade. Although that was well after Holmes Basic, of course.
I would play Unicorn the Masquerade, and I know Liz would too.
I would.
Yes. Unfortunately, because no matter what outfit they're masquerading as, the horn kind of gives them away.
There is a super awesome webcomic out there.
Oh, no.
With an anthropomorphic unicorn hero who is called Manicorn, and he goes around fighting crime and saving children in the dead of night. And
so he's a superhero.
Yes. So that kind of is Unicorn the Masquerade right there.
Is it written by Liz Stewart, perhaps?
By a radioactive Liz.
I could only wish that I had thought of this, because it is just so super awesome. So there
all right.
You.
Well, on that tragic, awkward note, we will head into makes the save and doesn't.
Last night, I journeyed backwards in time to the medieval world of Dark Tower. In this amazing game, I had to find three keys, lay siege to the tower, and defeat the enemy within. Each move was a challenge. The computer kept track, giving me secret information, pictures, sounds, surprises. Then, ahead of my opponent, I made my move. The battle was joined, and I was victorious. Dark Tower.
What makes the save, and what is going to take half?
What makes the save? What doesn't make the save? Because of that manicorn thing, I'm going to start with Liz. That'll teach her.
It's like totally no fair, man.
Totally.
Fine.
Manicorn makes the save.
Ha.
Okay, what makes the save? Holmes encourages DMs to penalize crappy behavior by players.
Oh, that was a good
that
one.
That makes the save. He says the dungeon master should have the option of lowering the number of experience points gained under special circumstances. If one character sneaks out of the dungeon with all of the treasure while the rest of the party is being eaten, he should gain some experience points, but not necessarily all of them.
You suck as a DM.
That's right, but you're not leveling up. I think that is awesome and makes the save.
What doesn't make the save?
What would Manicorn do now, Liz?
What would Manicorn do? Well, what doesn't make the save? The order of topics in the rulebook could be better. It could be better. Now, I will say, compared to the little brown books, this is laid out in an amazingly coherent fashion. So, based on what came before,
not much of a bar.
It's a huge improvement, but it still wasn't exactly great. I mean, for instance, the table of XP to level up for characters is not grouped with the text describing the character classes and how to roll them up. It's after the sections for traps, secret doors, and wandering monsters. So it's like you talk about characters, character classes, rolling your dice, etc., and then you go into buying crap for them, and then it talks about secret doors, and then it talks about traps, and then it talks about wandering monsters, and then you've got the table that tells you how many XPs you need to level up to a second level. So I think the table probably would have been better placed with the other character creation stuff. Other things, it's like you have half of the information on combat in one place, and then you've got the rest of it elsewhere.
Although, to be fair, Holmes does have a perforated page in the back with a quick reference of all pertinent tables.
Yes.
Which is nice.
That was very nice. Mm-hmm. And I lost my perforated page years ago because I tore it out and not keep it with the book. But yeah, I will say there was at least the makings of a mini DM screen right there. all of the special information in one place. But going through the booklet itself, you kind of have to flip back and forth sometimes to find everything you need about a particular topic. While I do love the Holmes booklet, it is still my favorite version of BASIC. That's one of the things that could have been improved upon.
Okay, Corbett?
All right. Something I would actually use, and I kind of have. I think I've seen it in other games where it's very similar, but he put in a monster or NPC reaction table, and it was it was pretty fun. It was like a light, simple, quick, attacks immediately, hostile reaction, uncertain, accepts offer, little things like that. It's like a D12, which I think is funny. There's a few D12 charts in the book.
D12!
With all the power of a unicorn.
Of a manicorn.
But yeah, it was a simple little reaction table that for some reason I kind of got giddy about, because I've been in those situations where, like, I don't know, I'll just roll. And suddenly they have to make dinner with the ogres. And
because the players do something you don't expect.
Yeah, throws
Let's
it all
sit down and have lunch with the ogres and discuss our differences.
Wow, how did you make so much money?
Okay.
Me invest in strong market.
You make Grom key lime pie? I love you.
I love you. How'd you get so much custard out of such a small cat? So it doesn't make the save.
Doesn't make the save. I didn't know this before, and I went back and reread it myself, but the prime requisite for your stat is how you get XP bonuses. So if you're like a fighter with a strength of 15 or something, then you get 10% XP, which is still in current D&D rules. However, the negative XP isn't where you go below the average, which is, I think, 8. Then you start losing XP based on every level. And I think that's incredibly lopsided and wrong, just because if you're really not good at your job and you do it just the same, you should be gaining XP faster, if anything. I mean,
it seems to invalidate some of what Liz was saying about the encouragement of hopeless characters. It's an additional punishment, it seems.
A little bit. I mean, it's just, it seems backwards somehow, or upside down, or left or right. What would an ogre do? I...
Ogre smash.
That would explain it. But yeah, that was my not makes a save. Great game.
That's your not makes a save.
Great, good thing, okay. Great game. And ogres travel in packs of 1 to 4, so remember that.
That's a four pack. Gotcha. All right. My makes the save. It's hard for me to look at the game totally objectively because it was my first RPG, my first gaming love. I still, just reading through the book, just find it so full of flavor and ideas, the way it was written. And it's better than a lot of different D&Ds which have been written and read kind of dry or technical. This doesn't. You can almost feel Holmes's enthusiasm for the game through it, I think. I just say I find the whole book a really kind of like the 1E DM's guide. Mm-hmm. Could it be better organized? Yeah. Is it self-contradictory here and there? But it just has some of that enthusiasm of the era that I just love, love, love. So it's hard to do that. The ease of character generation, I think I'll say at the time. Even today, you know, you can slap a character together in 20 minutes and be ready to play. And not many role-playing games can do that. So I think the simplicity of the rules, the cleanness of the system, I could do without the frickin' go see Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. But, you know, they were trying to sell products, so I can't grouse it too much.
Hear, hear. Now destroy it with your doesn't make the save.
Chits.
Was
frickin'... Chits.
I was going to say, did you say chits
or chits with a C?
Okay.
Chits.
What's
some
chit,
sets
man?
Went out with dice. Other sets, like the one I first got, came out.
And me.
Chits. You were a little cardboard you cut. It had like colored numbers, like 1 through 6 for a D6. You're supposed to put them in a Yahtzee cup, shake them up, and pull it out for your randomizer. I have heard contradictory stories about this. Some have said that the company that was originally supplying TSR with the polyhedrons had run out for a while because demand had been so high, because D&D was so exciting back then, everybody was buying. So they had to fill them with chits. I've heard others that this was a Brian and Kevin Bloom idea to cut costs and increase the profit margin. I don't know which is right, but I hated them. Hated them. I couldn't wait to get real dice.
Did you use the coupon that came in the book?
No.
I didn't either.
No,
I mean, I eventually got dice, but I did not use the coupon that said, use this, presented at your TSR outlet. Right. Yeah. Like, I've got one in Corpus Christi, Texas.
Actually, I think...
correct TSR hobbies. I didn't either. I just eventually found a place that sold dice and got some that way.
I think a relative of mine's kids had gotten the game for Christmas and didn't like it, and they didn't give a crap about it. And I'm like, well, do you mind if I have the dice? No, go ahead. Okay. And I had those low-impact booger dice. Woohoo! With the yellow D4s that could you can kill a man with.
But how many ogres could you kill with it?
1d4.
The pain.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Holmes Basic is not available in print or, I believe, as a legal PDF. There are other sources where you can get it, eBay, Noble Knight Games. It can be a bit pricey, so I would recommend you look at some of the retro clones out there who are somewhat faithful to Holmes, depending on which point of view you're trying to aim for. Perhaps Blue Holm would be a nice way of starting, a cheap way of starting out. Could be. Mm-hmm. We'll have to talk to somebody about it later, I guess. I don't know. But until then... this has been the Holmes Basic Dungeons & Dragons set, sold from between 1978 to about 1980. Buy one today, if you can find one.
Or find a friend, borrow it, and never return it.
Or find an ogre, kill them, take that $10,000 and buy a couple of copies of it.
It's not that expensive. And you can usually find some copies. They may not be mint condition, but you can usually find some pretty decent copies for a decent price if you are determined to have the actual book and not a retro clone. I know when we've been at North Texas, there have been several dealers who have had occasionally Holmes box sets in varying conditions that are not going to break your bank. If you look around, you can find one. It won't be that bad. I promise.
See, Liz promised.
I promise.
Liz promise right. is as well, good
as
any
ogre. It's
podcast
promise.
We know how good those are.
There's rules for podcasting, my friends. Can't just throw those out willy-nilly. Nuh-uh.
Of course there are. Anyway, well, this has been Holmes Basic, like I said. So hope you guys have fun, and we'll see you de nada. Say goodnight, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
Aklin ukskak. Oh, sorry, that's chaotic neutral. Good night.
Pre-arc, ogre style.
Podcast is a production of the Mud Puppy Games Network and the Gagman Podcast. The Save for Half theme music is provided by the band Mississippi Bones. You can find them at mississippibones.bandcamp.com. All player characters mentioned in this podcast are fictional, and any resemblance to PCs living or dead is purely coincidental. No NPCs were harmed in the making of this podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Save for Half.
Or did it seem like magic user and thief were so closely related they could really be the same character until, I don't know, third?
You mean like reading scrolls and stuff?
Why don't they just make one class that's called schmuck, and then later on you become the advanced schmuck?
Name level schmuck. You could form a schmuck stronghold. A schmuckhold.